Good morning, everybody. It is September 10th, 2021. This is your home away from homeroom, the ADK homeroom. I am your host, Frank, the teacher in exile, and I am coming to you straight from the heart of the Adirondack Mountains. Today, we got a great episode for you. We're going to talk about the Mackinac Island stomach pumper. We're going to talk about Biden's sweeping vaccine mandates yesterday, New York banning the sale of gas-powered vehicles starting a little bit later. We got the Friday pop culture quiz, and of course, in the second half of the program, we will continue our series taking a little closer look, an up-close look at Basquiat's idea of what you're missing. Today, we're going to focus on a few government spending programs like Medicaid, public education, and of course that third rail taboo almost topic, roads. Let's start things off with the science fact of the day. Guess who's going to fact tonight? That's Kanye. All right, Kanye sings that way better than I do. That album is fantastic. Go listen to it. So the Mackinac Island stomach pumper is indeed your science fact of the day. If you look on UrbanDictionary.com, you will find that the Mackinac Island stomach pumper has a listing, a vastly underrated listing. One part vodka. This is a drink here for the Mackinac Island stomach pumper. One part vodka, one part orange juice, and one part hot inside filling of a lava lamp. I mean, that's awesome, right? That is just an awesome image or an awesome idea. And it's real, at least as far as I know, according to rumors from northern Lower Michigan and Mackinac Island. I happened to have grown up right near Mackinac Island. A bunch of my friends had jobs in the summer on Mackinac Island. This is that resort island in between the lower and upper peninsulas of Michigan, right in the Straits of Mackinac there. A bunch of movies like Somewhere in Time have been filmed there. They don't allow cars, so it stinks because the horses are pooping everywhere. But it is true that I heard rumors, at least growing up, of people trying the Mackinac Island stomach pumper, getting air evacuated down to northern Michigan hospitals in Petoskey off of the island there. And who knows, I certainly did not ever try the stomach pumper myself, but there's a very good scientific reason that it's called the stomach pumper and that the Mackinac Island stomach pumper exists. And that reason is actually a really cool science story. Dr. William Beaumont lived on the island in 1822. He came there from Plattsburgh, which is right near the Adirondacks, where I am now. He participated in the Battle of Plattsburgh in the War of 1812, by the way. And by 1822, he was out at Fort Mackinac. And one day, he heard a bang and scream and shouts. And then a bunch of people came running in from the American Fur Company to Dr. William Beaumont. He was with the U.S. Army at Fort Mackinac there. They came into his office, his little building there inside the walls of the fort. I've seen it. And the fur trappers, they all ran in there, and they were carrying this guy named Alexis St. Martin. He was a Canadian, and this poor guy had injured himself with a shotgun, an accidental blast of a shotgun, and it went right through his abdomen. And Beaumont was like, well, this guy's a goner. He's done for. That's too bad. But you know what? I'm an amazing doctor. I'm going to go ahead and try to treat him anyway. And so Beaumont did treat him. And Alexis St. Martin lived, even though he's expected to die, he lived. And as he healed these gunshot wounds, one of them in his stomach, the lining of his stomach healed attached to his skin. Basically, this developed a fistula, a hole from the outside of this guy, St. Martin, straight into his stomach. So it was a port almost beyond the fistula we know into his stomach. And Beaumont looked at that after this guy had this miracle recovery. And Beaumont was like, well, that's pretty cool. I got to study me that. And so he did study that. He took pieces of food, tied them on strings, and he dipped it in there, right? That's like the portal in Tomb of Horrors when everybody ties, you know, the henchman up to a rope and says, jump through that portal there. That's what Beaumont did with a piece of food on a string, dipped it in, kind of pushed it into the past the fistula there into St. Martin's stomach. And then after 3 hours or so, he would pull it out and he would see how the digestion was going. At the time, people apparently thought that most digestion was actually mechanical, the mashing and the squeezing and the pumping in the stomach. But Beaumont was able to prove through this that it was mostly chemical. He also sucked out a bunch of gastric juices and stomach acid from the guy's stomach. He proved this French conjecture that was out there that there was hydrochloric acid in the stomach. And then he got a cup of this acid, stomach acid, and he'd dip in some mutton or some figgy pudding or a little chunk of apple, and he would see how it went out there. And so he proved, Beaumont proved in the 1820s, using St. Martin, that digestion was largely chemical. It was mostly a chemical process rather than a mechanical process. There is a little dark part to the story, too. At one point, St. Martin ran away. See, St. Martin was illiterate, and Beaumont signed him to a contract to be his handyman, his henchman, if you will. And it's questionable whether St. Martin really knew what was going on or not. But St. Martin, he couldn't work as a trapper anymore, a furrier, because of the injury. So he seems somewhat content to have worked with Beaumont, but not entirely willing. And at one point, he ran away. He went back to Canada. But Beaumont, probably through his connections in the army, had him hunted down and dragged back to the United States. I don't know exactly how it happened. I'm not sure anybody knows exactly how it happened. Maybe we could ask Australia. Zing! Sorry, Australia. Not sorry, actually, though. So yeah, St. Martin was brought back and proved that it wasn't the mechanical grinding, the mashing, squeezing. It was the gastric juices that dissolved it. He did studies then. He would look at the emotional state of his handyman, and he would try to excite him or try to calm him down, and he studied the digestion then. Finally, by 1838, St. Martin was finally allowed to go back to Canada. And Beaumont kept trying to get him to come back, but at last he failed. Beaumont published his results, and Beaumont has been famous ever since. That is your science fact of the day. Now let's move on to our first topic here. Yesterday, President Joe Biden announced his vaccine mandate for stretching even into the private sector now. So it's that all employers, if you have more than 100 workers, they have to be vaccinated or tested for the virus weekly. That's going to hit about 80 million Americans. Again, keep in mind that there are maybe 270 or so million working age Americans or adult Americans. Also, the 17 million American workers at health facilities, if the health facilities receive Medicare and Medicaid payments, then they have to be fully vaccinated. And that's how the government does it, folks, right? That's how the state has insidiously woven its way into the fabric of almost every aspect of American life. They don't say you have to do this. They don't say, oh, if you don't do this, you know, you're the first against the wall. They say, oh, well, it's just that if you want this Medicare money, if you want this Medicaid money, if you want this money for education, then you have to do what we say. We're not telling you have to do it. It's just that, you know, if you want this money, you have to do what we say. Of course, the trick is it's your money in the first place. It's your money that they confiscated through taxes. And then they say, oh, if you want it back, then you have to do what we say. But, you know, people fall for it. So that's the way it's been continuing to go for decades upon decades now. And of course, this violates the right to contract, right? The right to contract to have employees and employers sign their own contract, decide what they want to do. Maybe they want to have vaccines in their terms of contract. Maybe they don't. But nobody believes in the right to contract since at least Lochner, right in the very early parts of the 20th century. Most people think that a business is public property and you can't limit it just to your friends. You can't limit it just to people, whoever you want. As soon as you have business, you have to make it public. You have to put it up to the whims and at the mercy of the federal government. But of course, this scheme won't work anyway. United States is already at 210 million or so out of 290 million adults over 12 who have at least one dose. So that's about 70%, and about 60% of adults fully vaccinated, 53% of the total population fully vaccinated. Vaccination isn't going to stop things as much as he's hoping, right? At least according to what we're seeing in countries like Iceland and Portugal leading the world, right? And sizable populations that are fully vaccinated. I think Iceland's about 77%, Portugal 1 or 2% higher than that. And they're still having what a lot of people would consider out of control COVID cases. The cases in Iceland have shot up by 40% since the end of July. Portugal has also had a surge in cases, four times as many cases per day right now as in the original spring 2020 outbreak. And that's with almost 80% of your entire population vaccinated. So I don't think that this push to get the last 70 or so million out of 290 million people is going to do what the president thinks it will do or hopes that it will do. Vaccines have, of course, had an obvious effect on deaths. I'm fully vaccinated. I encourage everybody to get fully vaccinated, every adult to get fully vaccinated, of course. But as far as cases, and that's what this seems to be about, I don't think it's going to have the effect that the president intends. But we will see. We will see. Item number two on our news for today, the New York State banning the sale of all gas-powered cars after 2035, becoming the second state in the country to do this after California, of course, shouldn't make laws 14 years in the future, guys. That is a poor way to make policy. 14 years ago from now was 2007. Did we have any idea that the pandemic was coming up? Well, Nathan Myhrvold did, and some other people did. I did, right? It's been on my top five list of threats for forever. But most people would have said, oh, yeah, sure, why don't we ban some more light bulbs 15 years out? We can do that. We don't need to worry about anything else. No need to plan for anything like that. So by making this law 15 years in the future, laws have a lot of inertia. We know this. It's really hard to change and modify a law once it gets into place. So you are really putting a lot of confidence, arrogance I would say, in your ability to predict what the world needs in 2035. And for a state that has had as much dysfunction at the highest levels of government as New York State, I don't think that they're quite capable of predicting what the world needs in 2035. And of course, if you do ban gas-powered vehicles, they're going to be electric-powered vehicles, and the electricity has to be generated. Right now, still way more than half of all electricity generated in New York State electricity consumed in New York State is generated by fossil fuel sources. New York kind of tries to skirt around this sometimes. They try to make their numbers look better because they say the amount of electricity produced in New York State is roughly 25% hydro, maybe 25% renewable sources other than hydro, but that's the energy produced in New York State, and actually New York State consumes much more energy than that. They pipe in energy from Canada and from other places. So once again, this is looking extremely unlikely to accomplish what they intend to accomplish. You're just going to transfer the pollution, the greenhouse gases from the cities to other places. Now, I suppose that might marginally improve your living in the city, which is great, but somebody like me who doesn't live in the city, well, I'm going to be in for it, aren't I? And that takes away choice. This is exactly like when New York City banned smoking, and I was living in New York City. They banned smoking in indoor spaces like bars, and I was living over by 3rd Avenue, Murray Hill area, and a lot of restaurants, a lot of bars. I am not a bar guy, so I never went into the bars. But then as soon as they banned smoking, all of a sudden I got tons of extra secondhand smoke because I was walking down the streets and I was weaving through these crowds all the time, just smoking up chimneys right on the sidewalk there. Where previously I could have chosen to avoid that by not going into the bar. So really compromising some choice right there. And there is a bill in New York State that is, it's actually a law now, excuse me. And it says that by 2030, all the energy consumed in New York State has to be from renewable sources. So we're way over half right now. New York Times calls this goal to get all consumed energy in New York State from renewable sources, or consumed electricity, I think I should say, to renewable sources 50% by 2030. New York Times calls that goal ambitious. Yes, I would agree that is ambitious. I foresee power outages, rolling power outages, intentional power outages coming up in New York's future if this doesn't get changed. Let's go on to a couple other things now. Number three item in the news, Breyer, Supreme Court Justice Breyer, was interviewed again the other day, and NPR reporting on it, they had a good line. They said, not yet. Yeah, not yet. Breyer does not seem to be retiring yet. And of course, many people want him to retire quickly so that Biden can appoint his replacement. I have to say, I am pleased that we have not seen court packing yet. Court packing, of course, horrible idea, breaks down the rule of law, breaks down respect for law, and just enervates the Supreme Court and really the entire judicial branch of the government. Next item on the news, the Matrix Resurrections. Oh my goodness, did you see that trailer yesterday? I was a little bit excited. Yeah, I mean, come on, let's be honest. It's going to be impossible to be as bad as the other sequels, the second and the third one, but it's also going to be impossible to be as good as the original. I will say that White Rabbit, which was the song, the musical score for that trailer that came out yesterday, that was the perfect choice. Chef's kiss, moi. Absolutely wonderful. Salt base, sprinkling the salt on there. That was absolutely fantastic choice. It's the perfect song. It's so perfect that it actually gives me hope that that the Matrix Resurrection film is going to be fantastic. Kind of like Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith. I remember Howard Stern saying it was so good it made the previous two movies worth it. And there's something to that. We will see. If Matrix Resurrections comes out to be amazing. No green filter, apparently, in the Matrix scenes. There was that great, great genius. There's so much genius about the first film, but we don't know for sure if the scenes in the trailer that look like they're in the Matrix are really in the Matrix. Maybe that's why there's no green filter there. We don't know. A little bit hard to see if it's going to make sense. Does the movie even need to make sense, right? There is plenty of art out there that doesn't make sense. Kubla Khan, right, from Coleridge. Child Roland from Browning. These things don't make sense. And, you know, Stevie Nicks, Neil Diamond. Let's face it, most of their songs don't make any sense at all. The OA. But you know what? If The Matrix and Resurrections has style and kung fu, maybe it doesn't need to make sense. I don't think it does. I think it could be fantastic even if it doesn't, but we'll see. Making sense sure does help, so I hope that it does, but we'll see. Can't wait. Now let's do our Friday pop culture quiz. So if you watched that Matrix Resurrection trailer, you saw Carrie Ann Moss. Holy cow, unaging. She seems to be brought right out of the time capsule from 1999. And so that's going to be our theme for the Friday Pop Culture Quiz this week. Never aging, immortal, or at least seeking a longer lifespan. So, for example, if I say Gilgamesh, then you would say staying awake for 6 days and seven nights, right? Like he had to first to gain immortality and then he failed. Or I guess you could say finding the magical herb at the bottom of the ocean, because that would give him youth or restore his youth. And I would accept that. So I will say the name of a character or a person, and you tell me the method that they used to seek immortality or that they had to achieve immortality. Number one, Dorian 50 Shades of Grey. Yeah, that was an easy one to start with, getting you off on the right foot here on Friday. It was the picture, of course. The picture aged instead of Dorian Gray. And you do have to wonder, right, about 50 Shades of Gray and Dorian Gray. For example, in each case, both of the authors seem to not quite have the courage of their convictions, don't they? All right, number two, Roy Batty. Yes, he was the replicant from Blade Runner, and so his method for immortality was to walk right up to the guy who made him and say, make me live longer. But interestingly enough, what actually got Roy Batty immortal, at least in the annals of cinema, is that amazing dying soliloquy. Absolutely fantastic. Tannhauser Gate, Sea Beams. Fantastic. Number three, your clue is Voldemort. Yes, the Horcruxes, or for you Dungeons & Dragons players, the phylacteries. Except, apparently, J.K. Rowling didn't want to use that term. Maybe she never played Dungeons & Dragons. I don't know. Number four, Imhotep. That's right. Suck the skin and body parts off the people who help you get out of your cursed tomb. That was Imhotep was the mummy, of course, from the old Brendan Fraser movies. Number five, Blue Shirt Guy. His method for immortality? He's virtual. So he's going to stay young forever in his little virtual world there. Number six, Edward Cullen. Yeah, obviously he's a vampire. All right, so now let's go to Swan, but not Bella Swan. Last clue for today is just Swan, played by Paul Williams. Yeah. Sell your soul for everlasting rock and roll. Swan was the music producer, right? From the classic Phantom of the Paradise. And if you've never read about Phantom of the Paradise, that movie achieving its own immortality, because it's awesome, and also because Winnipeg went crazy for Phantom of the Paradise. Go read that story. It's really interesting. Sometime for that entire summer, Winnipeg just went to see Phantom of the Paradise. The people who live in Winnipeg, it was the number one movie in Winnipeg for week after week after week after week after week that whole summer. And, you know, it was nowhere near that popular anywhere else. So I don't know. What can you say? Winnipeg loves Phantom of the Paradise. By the way, another thing to point out there about our Immortality Friday pop culture quiz is they're all bad guys, right? Or cursed, except for Blue Shirt Guy. That's one of the really wonderful things, frankly, about Free Guy. Great name for a movie, Free Guy. Great thing. It's somewhat rare. In fact, it's almost, is it unique? I'm sure there must be some other film somewhere where the guy seeking immortality or the guy who has immortality or the guy who lives forever is the good guy. But it's not too common, right? Moon is a harsh mistress. Man, the AI. That's an AI, and he's a good guy. Very rare to have the AI be a good guy, but we all know how well the immortality went for a man in the Moon is a Harsh Mistress, don't we? So yeah, other than Blue Shirt Guy, right? Edward Cullen was a good guy, but he was cursed. Immortality was a curse, and all those other guys are bad guys and cursed. So I don't know. I think that it's slowly starting to change. We're slowly starting to make longevity a value here in our culture. But we have some ways to go, right? Art reflects culture, and art also influences culture. And right now in art, I'm still seeing most of the time immortality represented as a bad guy, a curse. And I think that needs to change because, gosh darn it, I wish somebody would invent that immortality serum. I wouldn't mind living effectively forever. I wouldn't mind having eternal youth. But who knows if that's in the cards. Now let's go to our close look. Second half of our program here. We're going to take a close look at something that is unseen. As we have been all week, we've been talking about Bastiat's idea of seeing that which is unseen. And we're going to look again at, in this case, an example of what is unseen due to state intervention. Next week, we're going to talk about maybe a little more optimistic things that are unseen. for other reasons than obfuscatory interventions by the government, by the state. But today, let's finish this off for this week just by looking at government spending, not only regulations. Yesterday, we did regulations and the burden of regulations and what we could have if we didn't have those regulations. Today, not even regulations. Let's just talk about spending. Just the fact that the government is going to spend some money, that's going to have some ramifications, and it's going to cause us to miss things which are easily unseen. So we're going to try to point out what those are. First, let me talk about Greece. I was driving around Greece one time, and the country, not Greece, New York, for those of you that live in upstate New York, and I saw all these unfinished houses. And I was asked, we had a tour guide, actually, and I said to the tour guide, you know, we've been here for a few weeks now, and I see tons of unfinished houses all over the place. You guys have a construction boom? What gives? And she says, oh, no. It's just that you get a tax break on your house. You don't have to pay taxes on your house, in fact, some aspects of the tax, until your house is finished. So nobody ever finishes building their house. And I said, oh, okay, that makes sense. Incentives matter. And in that case, it's really easy to see what is unseen, right? What is unseen there are the finished houses. All I saw were the unfinished houses all around the Greece countryside. What I didn't see, what would have been the benefit of not having that ridiculous rule, what would have been the benefit is actually finished houses. So in that case, it's easy to see the example, but let's look at a couple other examples. And like I said, we'll focus on government spending here. That story, not exactly on government spending, but more on tax policy. But here's an example in the United States of government spending. And this is going to be Medicaid. We spend a ton of money on Medicaid, of course, over half a trillion dollars per year, $640 trillion, I think, in 2019, and it's been growing fast. It's almost doubled in the decade before 2019. So we spend a ton of money on Medicaid, talking about Medicaid, different from Medicare. And the fact is that Medicaid makes old people poor. Why? Why does Medicaid make old people poor? Well, the thing is that the rules of Medicaid are that a nursing home is paid for by Medicaid, but only if you're poor. So the incentive here is to be poor. You have Laura M. Crone. She works out of Rhode Island. She does a lot of law work on Medicaid, and she has a couple of great pieces out on Medicaid spending out there. And she says that so to be eligible for Medicaid, you must become impoverished under the program's guidelines. And some people might say, well, that's not a big deal. Old people might have some money, but when they become poor so that Medicaid will cover their nursing home, what do the old people do? Well, they have a lot of money, so then they'll just give it away. They'll give it to their kids. They'll do something with it. They will get rid of their wealth, but it won't go away. It won't be destroyed. The wealth will be just somewhere else, and maybe this is a good thing. And then, yes, the old person is poor because he wants the nursing home to be paid for by Medicaid because he has a lot of money, but he doesn't have that much money to pay for the nursing home. So he gets rid of his wealth, but you might say, well, it doesn't get destroyed. The wealth is still in the world. Well, that's not actually how it works. See, because that was sort of how it worked up until Medicaid and this nursing home scheme got much worse in 2005. But in 2005, the feds wised up to this and they put a stop to it. They put in a five-year look back. So now if you want, since 2005, if you want Medicaid to pay for your nursing home, Medicaid will look back at your finances 5 years in the past. And if you had money anywhere within the last 5 years, then Medicaid still won't pay for your nursing home until you pay down at some prorated basis the amount that they think you should contribute. For example, if you donated $100,000 some certain number of months ago, and your nursing home is going to cost $5,000 a month, then you divide your $100,000 by your $5,000, and you get 20 months. You would have to pay 20 months of your own nursing home before Medicaid would kick in and cover the rest. So clearly, the incentive here is just to never generate that wealth in the first place, just never have it. Because what's to stop from a 6-year look back? What's to stop from a 10-year look back? Obviously, people are going to be making these decisions, and they're just never going to generate the wealth in the first place. And then you say, well, okay, so what are we missing here? What is unseen if people are just going to always choose to be poor? Well, it's hard to say. Maybe somebody would invent a matter transporter. Maybe we get some new flaming hot Cheeto Oreo combination that would be delicious. I might like that. Maybe you're going to have enough money, old person, to provide your daughter with a babysitting experience that would give her the confidence to laugh it off when some mean girl at school tells her she's too ugly to function. Who knows what is going to be out there? But you have to have imagination. You have to see that this wealth and that this ability to make your own choices and your own contracts could inspire you, could lead to new inventions, new medicines, more time with family. Your life doesn't have a fixed value. Your life can be improved. Your life can be made better by making your own choices, by having your own wealth. So it's really about the quality of the life. The quality of life would be improved in innumerable ways if you were given an incentive to actually create wealth rather than to become poor, as the current Medicaid legislation encourages you to do. Another example of government spending, it creates debt. And creating debt is going to have your kids paying for your choices in the future. This is like what we were just talking about with New York State predicting in 2035 what is needed. How do you know in 15 years what is needed? But when you spend now, when you create debt now, you're burdening someone else to pay it off in the future. And who knows? Maybe they're going to need that bill to fight that money in the future to fight another pandemic. Maybe they're going to need the ability to work in a field. Maybe they want to work in a field that it doesn't generate as much wealth as something else, but it generates happiness for them. And they feel pressure to not work in that. So the ramifications of government spending now and running up debt, it's really hard to see, but it's pretty easy to see that someone making decisions for the year 2040 right now is not going to have nearly as good information and probably not going to make nearly as good a decision as somebody making a decision about it in 2039 or, maybe 2040. So the government spending now, it takes away that ability to adjust, that flexibility. Government spending also drives out private competition. And then that destroys service because the customer isn't the payer. Let's use schools as an example here. I happen to know some schools that have suffered from this, right? Why would a person support a private school if the other school is a public school, is something that she already has to pay for through taxes? And her share of it is less because for a public school, she doesn't have to bear the full cost herself. The spinster down the road who never even had kids. Is forced to help this other person pay for her kids' education. So she's going to choose public school, even if it's 50% worse, because maybe it's 90% less expensive for her. But in the aggregate, of course, it's going to end up being even more expensive, partly because of the worse education, the worse service you get. And why would you get worse service there? Well, because think about who the teachers answer to. Think about who the principals answer to. In a private school, it is the people who pay them. In a public school, it is the people who pay them too. But who's paying them? The government, right? They are going to be more responsible to the state because the state is on the hook for getting them their funds. And they are on the hook to the state for using those funds as the state sees fit. And you see what I'm leaving out of the last couple of sentences here? What I'm leaving out is the actual parents and kids who go to that school. They are not the direct payers, so the teachers and the administrators in that school feel no need to, very little need other than conscience, to respect them and to service them. In fact, in my experience in most public schools, if you even bring up the idea that the parents are the customers of the teachers there, the teachers get insulted by that, and the administrators think that you have gone off the rails if you even suggest that the parents are in some sense their bosses and they are in some sense beholden to the parents for paying their salaries. I used to say that sometimes in my class, you know, your parents are paying my salary. Please make sure you call me. Please make sure you get in touch. And the kids would look at me with saucer eyes and get those cartoon Wittershin spins going on. But it's true. It's true. Now, what is unseen there? Well, better education. You could have maybe more boys going to college. Right now, it's 60% women, 40% boys going to college. And we could be educating a heck of a lot more boys. We could be more responsive to what they need, because clearly right now we are not being responsible to what boys need. I'm not decrying the fact that women are going to college at all, by the way. That is absolutely fantastic. But for example, in my high school, in the last dozen years, the valedictorian and salutatorian have been female and female 83% of the time. Only 18% of the val or sal, valedictorian or salutatorian, have been male in the last decade in my school. Our schools are doing a disservice to boys. And of course, if you look at life expectancy and things like that, and it's going down much more for men than for women. Suicide, of course, is a much more male problem than female problem. I think that we are really missing an opportunity there in education. And I think that the government spending on public education has shifted the incentives so that the teachers and the administration are much more responsive. I've seen it. I've seen it throughout my career. They care far more about what Albany and about what the state education department thinks than what the parents think. They even care more what their old college professors think than what the parents or their students think. Sometimes they're influenced just by the students, just because students are in class and students can talk to them, students can make them feel a little bit bad. But just about half the time, I would say, when I see a teacher that feels pressured by a student, that teacher responds perhaps just out of spite, even if the teacher feels honestly bad and the teacher sort of seems to recognize that they're not doing right by their students. Out of spite, sometimes the teacher just doubles down. They are not responsive in our current model. So that is what is unseen here in our messed up public education model. What is unseen is we could be doing so much better in education. And from there, who knows? Better medicines, better inventions. Maybe we would have better politicians, dare I hope, that might even have launched some sort of Orion project, to bring it back to the Monday's episode that I talked about. So it has this sort of concatenation, this chaining together of effects that could really benefit society. But we don't see it. We don't even think about it, because we just take it for granted that the public education system is here and it's how it should be. The last example I'm going to give you today, something that is unseen because of government spending, is the roads. I just talked a little bit about education. Let's talk about roads. Anybody who has driven in a major city, with the exception maybe of Buffalo, because they lost half their people over the last century, so they've got this road infrastructure system set up for a population double of what they have now. So it's actually not too bad in Buffalo. But in almost any other major city in the United States, the traffic is tremendously bad. So much time is wasted we could have so much better roads. And why? Why does this happen? Well, the incentives are all messed up. Think about it right now. The government is spending the money. The government is financing the roads. And so you're in charge of the roads. You want to have more money devoted to your department, public choice. You want to have more prestige, more power, bigger budget. Of course, you're going to want these things. It's in human nature. How do you get it? Well, if your road is functioning perfectly, you're not going to get more money from the state. The state's going to look at you and says, hey, you're doing a great job. Keep it up. Way to go. More money? What for? You're already perfect. Maybe you'll get like a medal. Maybe they'll say, you know, hey, thumbs up. But you're not going to get that more power. You're not going to aggrandize your department. You're not going to subsume other departments like the Department of Asphalt and the Department of Painting Yellow Lines. No, but you want that, right? So what do? Well, you sure don't function well. You have to function poorly. You have to function poorly. And then you can go to the state. You can go to whoever is holding the purse strings and you can say, ooh, gosh, we're so close. We just need a little bit more cash. Just give me a little bit more cash and then we'll be in great shape. See, we got all these people out here suffering. You have to spend the money. You don't want these people suffering, do you? And then they give you the money. The incentive is to make people suffer. It's ridiculous. I mean, imagine it the other way, right? Now try to see what is unseen. See how it works if it were a private road. So the private road, you're owning a private road. You want people to drive on your private road. Are you going to advertise suffering? No, you're not going to advertise suffering. You're going to make it convenient for people. You're going to make it nice. That's what your incentive now is. If you want people to drive on your road, they have other choices. They could go in many other different directions. And if you're thinking, oh, no, everybody has to drive on a road, then your life experience has not been broad enough. I've lived in many places where you absolutely can get by without having to drive your own car on a public road. So you own a private road and you need people to drive on it. You want that road to be successful for them. So that's what's unseen with our current system. What's unseen is actually good roads, where you're not stuck in a traffic jam, where you don't pull onto I-10 at 11:45 p.m. right before midnight on a Wednesday night out in Southern California, and you're stuck in traffic. That's what happens right now. Try to imagine a world where that doesn't happen, and you're starting to see what is unseen. All right, folks. Of course, we haven't even touched. I guess I'll just add, we're about to wrap it up here, but we haven't even touched on the meta benefits, right, of cutting government spending, right? Increased self-esteem as a result of self-reliance. You set up this sort of positive feedback cycle between freedom and productivity, inspiration, you know, cultural inspiration, artistic inspiration, and you start sort of establishing this mindset of growth in industry instead of confiscation and disability. So there's all that other all those other great results. I call them the meta benefits of cutting government spending. We were just trying to focus on some very specific ones here too, but the meta benefits might be even more important, and they're in some sense even harder to see because it's hard to measure a cultural effect. We don't have some sort of panopticon, at least the NSA isn't sharing it with us, if they have it, where we can just go through the panopticon and we can have some AI, like in Tony Daniel's Metaplanetary, it was actually kind of torture for the AI, but sift through all this data constantly, tediously, and tally up every little minor detail. It's really hard to measure a cultural change, at least in the short term, at least in specific things, at least in some sort of control variable scenario where you can ascribe, yes, we got this awesome computer chip. Yes, we have this amazing League of Legends online game because we allowed the tech industry to develop without state interference. We allowed this to happen without meddling and without setting up a publicly funded competitor that was going to ruin what would actually have produced more wealth in both the long term and the medium term. So those benefits can be very hard to measure, but sometimes they are easier to appreciate. That's going to be it for today's episode, folks. We started about with the Mackinac Island stomach pumper. How fantastic was that? Then, of course, we talked about Biden and the sweeping vaccine mandate. Oof. New York bans the sale of all gas-powered vaccines. And I suppose since we talked about what was unseen today, let's end with a poem about the unseen. Kind of liked ending yesterday with the wind hover, so here we go. One of my favorite poems. I'm going to read it to you in English. This is Rilke from the German. Amazing, by the way, cameo or at least allusion to Rilke on Ted Lasso the other day. Maybe we'll talk about that next week. So Rainer Maria Rilke here, and this poem is about something unseen. This is the Howard A. Landman translation, by the way. Not always a big fan of translations and poetry, but I think this is the perfect poem for what we've been talking about and to send us off into the weekend. Howard A. Landman translation, Rainer Maria Rilke, The Unicorn. Oh, this is the animal that never was. They knew it not, but loved it anyways. From its neck, its prancing, its pose, to the light of its tranquil gaze. Of course it wasn't real, but it grew pure because they loved it. Always they left space, and in the space, uncluttered and so clear, it hardly needed to exist, yet raised its head. They never fed it any corn, just always hope. To be was possible. And this gave such strength to the animal that it bore on its brow a horn, one horn. All white, it came up to a virgin girl and was in the silver mirror and in her. Okay, folks, you have a great weekend. We will pick it up again on Monday. Fantastic week of episodes coming up. Enjoy.